Sea Grant and Lake Michigan, Waters in Transition. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Episode 8, Deep Dives, Hypoxia, and Eddy Correlation. Welcome back. Well, I won't have to travel very far to make this episode. If you caught the previous podcast, then you'll know that the series is currently at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. I'm here speaking with their top scientists about some of the environmental challenges facing Lake Michigan. Right now, I'm heading down the hall to speak with Val Klump, a professor and associate dean of research here at the School of Freshwater Sciences. I noticed when he joined me that he had brought along a graduate student with him as well. I began by asking him about a new project that Sea Grant is helping fund. Could you give me some details on that?
Sure. I suspect that you've heard from other people that the big changes that occurred in Lake Michigan as a result of the invasion of these dry synod mussels, which now carpet the entire bottom of the lake. One of the things that has changed then is the extent to which the bottom functions in the whole ecosystem and what role it plays in the food chain. Not very much is known about the metabolism of these communities now in the Great Lakes. And so the project that we have is looking at developing new methods to try and measure that benthic metabolism by looking at the exchange of oxygen between the overlying water and these mussel beds.
You have a Sea Grant-funded grad student that's helping you with this project. You are...
I'm Shelby Laboon, and I'm a PhD student in Val Klump's lab at the School of Freshwater Sciences.
What are you going to be doing in this project?
One of my primary goals in this project with the benthic respiration rates is to set up and deploy the new eddy correlation method. This eddy correlation method relies on the assumption that most of the oxygen flux into and out of the benthic system is due to turbulence. So we have a high frequency acoustic Doppler vector, or an ADV, and we link that with a high frequency micro oxygen electrode. Through that and some math correlation, we can determine the overall flux of oxygen into or out of the benthic zone. The acoustic Doppler vector relies on the Doppler effect, which sends out a sound pulse and measures back the reflection of sound waves, and that can tell you the velocity of the bottom water. We couple that with a corresponding oxygen concentration measurement over a period of 10 to 12 hours, and that gives us the flux over a time period.
The Doppler effect, named for the Austrian physicist Christian Doppler, who tested it by putting a brass band on a train in the 1840s, is the change in frequency of a wave for an observer moving relative to its source. You probably remember this from physics class, but here's an example. How it works. When a wave source, and this includes light waves and water waves, is moving towards the observer, each successive wave crest is emitted from a position closer to the observer than the previous wave. Therefore, each wave takes slightly less time to reach the observer than the previous wave. So the time between the arrival of successive wave crests for the observer is reduced, causing an increase in the frequency. As they travel, the distance between successive wave fronts is reduced, so the waves are compressed. Conversely, if the source of the waves is moving away from the observer, each wave is emitted from a position farther from the observer than the previous wave. So the arrival time between successive waves is increased, and that reduces the frequency. The distance between successive wave fronts is increased, and the waves expand. Naturally, I had to ask,
what does this acoustic Doppler system sound like? Does it make a cool sound?
I don't think it makes any sound.
I don't think you can hear it. It's all underwater, unfortunately.
Rats. Okay, back to our story.
Kind of get how the sound works. Yeah. How do you tell about the oxygen?
We have an amplifier that amplifies the signal because you are looking at very low oxygen concentrations. So there's a company up in Vancouver that makes this amplifier that we can plug our sensor into. And we couple that with this turbulence or this vector effect again. And it gives us the measurements that way. We're still putting it together. We'll be deploying it for the first time this summer. So hopefully we'll get some good numbers out of it and I'll have more of a story to tell at that point.
So you're measuring the electrons of the oxygen.
The cool thing about this technique is that when measuring oxygen fluxes or exchange of oxygen with the bottom in the past, you either have to put a chamber on the bottom in which you enclose a portion of the bottom, or you do a profile where you stick a measuring device down into the sediments or into the bottom. Both of those are kind of invasive, and you can change the dynamics of the oxygen exchange just by putting a chamber with it. The advantage of the eddy correlation technique is that it's totally non-invasive. All you're doing is measuring the turbulence above the bottom and the oxygen concentration and correlating when the turbulence is up, the oxygen concentration, if it's being sucked in by the sediments, goes down, and when the turbulence is down, the oxygen concentration goes up. And by correlating those, you can get an estimate of the exchange of oxygen in environments which would be very difficult to do any other way, whether it's covered by mussels, or it might be cladophora beds, or a rough topography, something which wouldn't be amenable to a chamber or another technique. This technique's been used in marine systems, but it's never been used in the Great Lakes.
That sounds just crazy cool that you can measure that stuff without having to disturb anything. I think most people would intuitively think, well, yeah, if you enclose a piece of water at the bottom of a lake, it's going to change it just by the action of doing it.
Right. Well, I hope it's crazy cool. We'll see if it works.
That's the crazy part.
The theory, eddy correlation theory, actually developed by atmospheric scientists to look at gas exchange and exchange of heat and momentum at a water-air interface. They use the same principle. But the application in totally aquatic environments is relatively new. Shelby's working with a couple of colleagues that are the leading gurus in this field, one from University of Washington, Claire Limers, and another one from the University of Virginia, Peter Berg. So we're getting help. We're not just doing this on our own.
Are you going to be using underwater robots to do this, or what's going on with that?
Well, in shallow water, you can use a diver or even wade if it's not very deep, and that's what we'll do in shallow water. But right, in deep water, when you get below maybe 20 meters or so, then it's really outside their comfortable range of diving. And that we can use an ROV to do that. So we'll develop a system which will allow us to deploy this gadgetry on the bottom so we could go at any depth in the Great Lakes. That's the goal. Over the course of this two-year project, we'll deploy the system, hopefully, at a whole variety of depths in a whole variety of different environments in the Great Lakes. One of the places Shelby is going to be studying will be Green Bay. Green Bay, of course, had a long history of nutrient enrichment, so it's a very hyper-eutrophic environment. It has excessive algal blooms. When those algae die and sink to the bottom, they start consuming oxygen. And as a result, in the summertime, when the lake stratifies, the bottom water can become low in oxygen. In fact, at sometimes it can actually go to zero. And there have been a couple of instances in what are known as hypoxic waters actually blobbed their way down into the southern end of the bay to have driven fish right up onto the shore because they didn't have enough oxygen in the water. So it's been a long-standing problem in Green Bay, and we're trying to figure out what the dynamics are that control that process. What controls hypoxia? And it turns out it's pretty complicated. The remedial action plan, in order to correct this problem in Green Bay, calls for about a 50% reduction in nutrients and suspended sediment loading to the system. And so we have a project which is not funded by Sea Grant, but builds on a lot of work that we have done supported by Sea Grant over the years to try and understand this. It involves not only the group here studying the biogeochemistry of oxygen in the system, but also a group in the School of Engineering here at UW-Milwaukee developing the hydrodynamic model, the circulation of the bay, because that's very important, and a group at UW-Green Bay that are studying what really drives this whole system, and that is nutrient inputs from the watershed. And that's what really causes the algal blooms. That's what causes eventually the hypoxia. The group at UW-Green Bay are looking at modeling the watershed and saying, okay, if we put a certain amount of best management practices in place, buffer strips, contour plowing, rotating different kinds of crops, and practices in the city as well, what kind of reduction could we get today? And could we meet that 50%? In this project, we're going one step further, and we're asking the question, okay, what would it take in the future with a changing climate? Because it's predicted to be both wetter and warmer. Both of those tend to exacerbate the problem. Warmer tends to mean a longer growing season and a longer stratified period. And it's that stratified period in which the bottom water is essentially sealed off from the atmosphere. The longer that is, the longer the oxygen has to last, the more prevalent hypoxia becomes. And wetter means that runoff from the landscape generally comes in those big rainstorm events. In a place like Green Bay or the western end of Lake Erie, Saginaw Bay, places that have these problems with respect to huge algal blooms, the major driver for that is runoff from the land. The climate change projections for this region are for it to be both wetter and warmer. The wetter part is projected to come in more frequent big rainstorm events. And as it turns out, 70 to 80% of the loading from the watershed comes in those 10 days in which you get a lot of rain. One of the things we're doing with this particular project is we're collaborating with a group at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Center for Climatic Research, Dan Vimont and Dave Lorenz, and they're developing the middle and end of century projections for climate. So we're going to take those projections for climate, daily precipitation, temperature, et cetera, put those in the models that we have developed for the watershed inputs, for the hydrodynamics of the bay, and try to come up with what the bay would look like under a changed climate and what impact that would have on hypoxia. It isn't going to be that easy to do, but we're making the effort, let's put it that way.
All right, that explains the dead alewives the dog was munching on, as well as those stinky parts of the sand at Harrington Beach State Park that were covered in green algae. I took pains to keep the dog away from those areas. Val summed up the crucial implications of the work that they are doing.
It's important for managers, if you're going to implement a set of practices which can get you the nutrient reductions you think you need today, the question is, will they suffice in the future as well? And so there's a real applied aspect to this work. The key is to couple all of these models, the climate change models, the watershed models, the hydrodynamics, the biogeochemistry. That's the challenge, getting all of those to interface. So that's our goal.
So you're looking more towards the adaptive management practices that people are going to have to adopt in the future,
right,
to deal with climate change. That still floors me that 70 to 80% of the sediment for places like Green Bay comes in, what, 10 days of rain?
And that's true of most watersheds. If you look at Lake Erie, for example, the western end of Lake Erie in 2011 had the largest algal bloom they've ever seen. And this goes back to the days before the Clean Water Act. Well, 2011 was an extremely wet year. They had about three or four big rainstorm events in early April, early May, which flushed a tremendous amount of nutrients into the system. And then they had a very warm and sort of quiescent summer. So the stuff was just like a big cooking vat, huge blooms of algae. 2012, as you know, was just the opposite. It was a very dry year. As a result, they had about 10% of the algae that they saw in the previous year. So the dynamics of climate have a big impact on the Great Lakes, and particularly these coastal embayments and areas like Green Bay.
So, Shelby, have you been at UW-Milwaukee long?
I got my bachelor's degree in environmental chemistry from Lake Superior State University in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, so eastern UP, and I've been at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee for the past year and a half. I'll be finishing my second year of classes in May. I've been part of Val's lab since June 2011.
Okay, so you've been a hand here for a while. You were getting your degree in?
I'll have a PhD in freshwater sciences with a focus in biogeochemistry. I would really like to stay in the Great Lakes area and help out. I like to joke around I'm doing my Great Lakes tour. I was born and raised in Lower Michigan, 15 minutes from Lake Huron. I went to school on Lake Superior, and now I live on Lake Michigan. So I have a tie with the Great Lakes, and I'd really like to stay in the area and help see them improve.
We just started a project for Seed Grant called Changing Benthic Metabolism in the Great Lakes. And it's looking at the role that the benthos now plays, particularly in Lake Michigan, but in all the Great Lakes, as a result of this invasion and total carpeting now of the bottom by these dry-scented mussels. In the last 10 years, there's probably been as large a change in the Lake Michigan ecosystem as has ever occurred. And you could now essentially walk across Lake Michigan, if you could, on a carpet of quagga mussels. Most of the energy and nutrients, et cetera, that went in to feed a pelagic food chain, which supported phytoplankton, zooplankton, bigger zooplankton, little fish, bigger fish, has now been shunted to the benthos and is feeding the vast quantities of these mussels. Shelby and I were at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and the latest estimate is there are 900 trillion quagga mussels in Lake Michigan.
900 trillion? Somebody just fainted. Shelby, just in case somebody who's listening doesn't know, could you tell us what Val means by pelagic and benthic zones in Lake Michigan?
The pelagic zone is the surface water. Some consider it more near shore areas where the light penetrates. And the benthic zone is the region right above the sediment water interface.
Sometimes people hear pelagic and they think whales and big right. open water species.
Think of pelagic as suspended or swimming around in the water. Benthic is on the bottom. So what's happened at Lake Michigan, we've gone from a pelagic or a water column dominated food chain to a bottom or benthic dominated food chain. It's a huge change in the system.
Well, if you're looking at this as a mussel, isn't this great news? Hey, this is new territory, new turf. Why shouldn't we be here if we were lucky enough to hitch a ride on a ship?
Right. Yeah. And they're here to stay. There's no question about it.
Speaking of walking across the bottom of Lake Michigan on the backs of some quagga mussels, I was reading that the only person to have reached the bottom of Lake Michigan happens to be Val Klump. Could you tell me about that?
This was in 1985. We were involved in a research program which brought in a manned submersible system from Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institution. We did a series of dives in Lake Superior, and then a year or two later, we did dives in Lake Michigan. So I got to go to the deepest spot in both Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. It just happened to be I'd be the first guy to do it. I wasn't the only person to do it. But in any case, that was pretty cool. The manned submersible, the Johnson Sea Link, looks like one of these bubble helicopters where the scientist and the pilot sit in a big plexiglass sphere that's about 6 inches thick and about 6 feet in diameter. It's a little cramped. You dive to the bottom. It takes about 20 minutes. And of course, for most of that, it's absolutely black. It's dark. There are no lights. So it was pretty exciting, I have to admit. And it was a big project, involved a lot of investigators. It was the first time I'd ever been in a manned submersible, so it was pretty cool.
What's at the bottom of Lake Michigan, and did you plant a flag?
No, we didn't plant a flag, but we the bottom of the lake at that time was mud. I suspect now, at least in Lake Michigan, is quagga mussels. But we were interested in studying how sediments are deposited in the lake, because Lake Michigan is a closed system. So for all intents and purposes, anything that gets into the lake stays there indefinitely. And the major sink for material, whether it's a contaminant or a natural substance, is burial in the sediments. Sediments accumulate Lake Michigan about a millimeter per year. And so we were looking at the process that controls that sink, how efficient it is. So we were using a submersible to carefully collect very nice sediment cores. And then by looking at the different layers in those cores, we can tell how old the material is using certain kinds of radiochemical techniques for dating out, sort of like carbon-14, although a much shorter half-life. Yeah, it was a pretty cool project.
Well, that's all we have time for. In the next podcast, we'll be speaking with a true guru of lakes, John Jansen. Please join us. This is Chris Bocast. Till next time. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Thanks for listening.